Charles Darwin, Professor of Animal Embryology at the Physiological Laboratory, Cambridge, England. He also is the WHO consultant for human reproduction. And he will talk about the method and morals of test tube baby production this afternoon. May I invite our renowned speaker, please, Professor Austin.
Thank you, Dr. Fassett. Ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me clearly at the back?
I need to hold it like that.
Right.
This makes it easier. I feel like a pop singer. I think, first of all, I should explain why this work was done. It is done in order to help women who are sterile because of the blockage to the oviduct, as I've indicated here. This is meant to be a diagram of the human female genital tract. And normally...
That's a good idea. Thank you.
Of course, the oocyte released from the ovary will pass into the oviduct and become fertilized and undergo initial development, passing into the uterus for implantation. But in quite a large number of women, there is a blockage in the oviduct, or else they are even, in a few instances, born without an oviduct or with a very defective one. Most of the reason for this blockage is due to a bacterial infection, a sexually transmitted condition, which is referred to generally as the pelvic inflammatory disease. Several different organisms are involved, or PID for short. The reason for that is, for the term pelvic, is that the infection passes up the tract out through the opening of the oviduct and involves this part of the peritoneal cavity, so that the disease affects the surface of the ovary as well. But the particular problem that we are concerned with is this blockage that occurs in the oviduct. The frequency of pelvic inflammatory disease is increasing in almost every society, partly because of the changing fashion of sexual morals. And so the incidence in England is thought to be something like 50,000. That is to say, about 50,000 women in England are sterile because both oviducts are blocked owing to this, having had this condition. The population in England is about 56 million, and I believe your population is 50 million, so you could think in terms of something like the same number of women in this country who could perhaps benefit by the procedure that has been developed and is called, for convenience, the test tube baby. The term is misleading because it suggests that a whole baby is produced in the laboratory. Far from it, we only produce an embryo, the embryo that would have been able to pass through that region of the oviduct. What happens is the oocyte is taken from the ovary, fertilized in the laboratory, allowed to grow for two days, during which time it would normally have gone through this region, and then it is replaced by being passed through the cervix here by means of a catheter into the uterus, and with the hope that it will implant. Could I have the first slide, please? And so, first of all, hello, are you with me, or am I with you? question of the definition of the term as we use it. That is, test tube baby is a name for a method of establishing a pregnancy in a woman, using one of her eggs and fertilizing it with sperm from her husband. That is to say, not anyone else's husband, nor is the egg obtained from anyone else in order to overcome the infertility in this woman. We can discuss that point later, because it has often been suggested that sterile women could have embryos derived from other women implanted in them, but that leads to problems of a social and legal nature which we wish to avoid in this particular work. Now, the history of the test tube baby is shown here. It's a little indistinct, I think, perhaps from the back, but I'll read it out. In 1967, the work began in the Marshall Laboratory, which is the unit at Cambridge for which I'm administratively responsible. I was not, however, involved actually in this work of the test tube baby. Almost throughout, the work has been that of Dr. Edwards, R.G. Edwards, and Dr. Patrick Steptoe. But it began with us in the Marshall Laboratory, where we were first concerned with experiments on fertilizing mouse and hamster eggs in the laboratory. And it was in our laboratory that David Whittingham, as a visitor, was able to first fertilize mouse eggs. This was the first time anywhere. And since then, hamster eggs, these two animals, had become routine procedures. Having done that, Edward then passed on to human eggs and began experiments on fertilizing these. This turned out to be easier than he thought. One expects everything to be more difficult with humans, but that's not true. In this work, man and mouse are very similar. The human egg is just as easy to fertilize and grow in the laboratory as the mouse egg. So after a few years, the work then shifted to Oldham General Hospital at Oldham, which is a town halfway up England, about 200 miles from Cambridge. The work then continued for several years before the first success in 1977, when the first baby was born, and then a year later the second baby. Soon after that, Dr. Steptoe's appointment at that hospital had to be terminated because he reached retiring age. But he and Dr. Edwards had now established a private clinic near Cambridge. This is a new clinic developed especially for this work at Bourne near Cambridge. And they had already begun to take in patients. They had some 20 or 30 of them at various stages of this work at the present time. And it is hoped that in the near future we may see more babies born. The method involved is, first of all, to obtain, as I mentioned, an oocyte from the ovary, and this is done with the aid of a laparoscope. This is a laparoscope here. Incidentally, this is Dr. Steptoe. Now, the laparoscope is inserted into the abdomen through a small incision made commonly in the navel, so that the scar will not show afterwards. It's only a small incision, and any other object that is passed into the abdomen is even smaller, so that as an operation it is very mild. It only takes a few minutes and the woman can leave the hospital the next day. a general anesthetic is used, but that is simply to obtain total relaxation, because a local anesthetic would be sufficient for that kind of operation. The abdomen is inflated with an inert gas so as to make the ovary more easily visible, and also the woman is tilted so that her pelvis is high and the abdominal organs will tend to move away from the region being investigated. The laparoscope is like a telescope with illumination. A light is passed by means of fiber optics through this tube and down, and one gets an extremely clear view of any structure inside the abdominal cavity, including, of course, the ovary. It can, of course, be focused, and it enlarges the object so that examination is extremely easy. This particular instrument, I do not know the nature of, because the operation here is being done for a different purpose, but when this is done in order to recover the oocyte from the ovary, we need to have, in addition to the laparoscope, a long needle connected with a plastic tube. This is the collecting device. This long needle is passed through the abdominal wall. It's connected by means of plastic tubing to a small flask, and this has also entering it a wide bore tube with a Y piece. This is connected to a vacuum pump, and that end can be stopped with a finger so that you can, for a short moment, cause a negative pressure in here sufficient to suck out, to withdraw the contents of the follicle. So follicular contents arrive in this collecting flask, and then the egg is examined to make sure that it is an ovulatory oocyte, that is to say, that it was due to ovulate in a short time, and therefore will, after 1 or 2 hours in culture, be suitable for fertilization. When that state is reached, the egg is placed in a small droplet like this. This particular setup is in fact what was being used for some mouse studies, where the eggs and embryos were placed in droplets, but exactly the same device is used for the human egg. This is a culture medium, and it's covered with a layer of liquid paraffin to prevent evaporation. The dish is placed in an incubator in which the atmosphere is maintained at 5% CO2 in air. It's important, it's vital to have that atmosphere, 5% CO2, because the buffer in the culture medium is bicarbonate, and you can only obtain the right pH if the atmosphere contains the right amount of carbon dioxide. So this preparation is then placed in the incubator and examined the next day to make certain that fertilization has taken place. And that can be seen by the presence of two pronuclei in the egg. Here's one sperm and a couple of others. Commonly, the egg is not examined as closely as this, because one does not wish to subject it to the rather unpleasant conditions that are needed to be able to see the details as clearly as that. So this photograph was taken during the experimental period when Dr. Edwards was finding out the best ways of fertilizing and culturing eggs. The egg is then cultured until it reaches the 8-cell stage, and it reaches that in 2 days from fertilization, and it is then ready for returning to human. So the oocyte and the early embryo are outside the abdominal cavity, are outside the mother for only 3 days altogether, which returns to the cervix, and the hope is then that it will implant in the uterus in the normal way. But this, as you will see, constitutes one of our major problems. The rate of fertilization development was worked out by Edwards in the early stages and is shown here some 7 to 10 hours after semination, after the sperms were placed with the eggs, the condition of sperm penetration could be detected. It takes a time for the sperms to undergo capacitation, and in any event, it is a time, it does take some time for the sperm to pass through the surrounding follicle cells that accompany the egg and penetrate the outer membranes. And then you see development proceeds steadily, reaching the 8-cell stage at about 48 to 60 hours after the semination. It can be grown further. It will go not only to the 16-cell stage, but also to the blastocyst. But there seems to be no advantage in growing the embryo any further than the 8th cell, because what evidence we have for normal human pregnancy indicates that the egg is entering the uterus at about the 8th cell stage. So that would seem to be the right time to return it, and also we wish to avoid too long an exposure to environmental, to laboratory conditions. Now, then becomes the question of the patient. Having worked out the procedures for collecting the oocyte and fertilizing it and culturing the embryo, it was then necessary to arrive at certain criteria for selecting patients. First of all, it's necessary, of course, that the patient has a normal functioning accessible ovary, or two ovaries, because, as I mentioned, the pelvic inflammatory disease is apt to produce adhesions around the ovary, so that some women with blocked oviducts cannot be helped because their ovaries also are so badly damaged or so inaccessible owing to adhesions that it's not possible to obtain an oocyte. So the ovary has to be accessible, normally functioning, because of course the progress of pregnancy depends upon a normal functioning ovary. By the same token, we need a normal healthy uterus if the embryo is to implant. The oviduct can be faulty, but the uterus must be healthy. They make it a condition that the women selected for this treatment have corneal blockage, that's blockage of the oviduct, or absence or malfunction. As I mentioned, some women are born actually with defective or absent oviducts. Now, this is made a condition because the treatment is intended to help just those women who have blocked oviducts, not every woman who is infertile. And if the oviduct is open and functional, then the cause of infertility is something else and not due to the blockage. So the woman has to qualify by having a blocked oviduct. And the husband's semen must be free of bacterial or viral infection, naturally, because it is going to be used for fertilizing the eggs. Then the woman is subjected to close examination, first of all assessing the ovarian cycle by determining hormone levels at different stages. It's important that the cycle is reasonably regular, that menstruation is occurring in a normal manner, and also general features of the cycle are investigated. The semen is analyzed for bacterial and mycoplasma virus cultures as a further precaution that it is normal. It's necessary to exclude toxoplasma infection in the woman, and of course to make sure that she hasn't got German measles. The cervix and vagina are examined to make certain that there is no infection in those regions of the tract, either by bacteria or by viruses. And then finally, there is the laparoscopic examination to see if the ovaries are accessible and to see whether any adhesions can perhaps be removed by glycemy or at least adhesiolysis. Now, several hormones will be mentioned, and in case you're not familiar with these abbreviations, I thought we'd just list them. HMG is human menopausal gonadotropin, and this has a strong stimulatory effect on the ovarian follicles. It stimulates growth of follicles. And the object of this, of course, was to make sure that at least one, and preferably more than one, follicle is developing at the time when the work is done to obtain the oocytes. Now, it's better to be able to get two or three oocytes rather than just one, as that naturally improves the chances of fertilization and normal development. HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, was used to induce ovulation and also at a later stage to help maintain the corpus luteum, which is essential for at least part of pregnancy. Clomiphene was used. This is a synthetic steroid which induces release of pituitary hormones. Primolat is a proprietary name, a commercial name. It's a pituitary preparation which helps to maintain the corpus luteum. And then there's progesterone, which is the hormone of the corpus luteum, and as I say, that is necessary for the establishment of pregnancy. Now, this general procedure I have mentioned, here we have a few more details. Well, there are two programs of procedure of work that were tried. This is the first program, and I have to tell you right at the beginning that it was not successful for reasons which I think can be explained later. It was the second program which was successful, which had been successful, and I will give you details of that later. But in the first program, the patient was treated with hormones, that's PMS, HCG, again I'm wrong, HMG, human menopausal gonadotropin, to stimulate follicles, and this was injected soon after menstruation so as to develop several follicles, and then HCG was given to induce ovulation, and it was determined by observation that ovulation occurred about 37 hours after the HCG injection. It was important to get the oocyte from the follicle just before it was due to be ovulated. If you take it too early, that means it will have to undergo maturation in vitro. And from other work, it has been shown that normal maturation does not seem to occur in vitro. The fetuses, this is experimental animals, the fetuses have been abnormal when the oocyte has to mature in vitro. So the oocyte is obtained just before ovulation, when maturation it has been virtually completed. The egg then removed from the patient 32 hours after HCG, semen sample obtained from the husband, which is then examined and diluted. The sperms are washed, and then the sperms and egg are put together for fertilization. The preparation is examined a bit later to ensure that fertilization has occurred, and this is judged not by, see now that they're in work on actual patients, the egg is not subjected to difficult conditions, but fertilization is judged from the behavior of the surrounding follicle cells. Edwards has the experience now to be able to recognize an oocyte that has been fertilized because of the changes in the position and appearance of the follicle cells. So if it's fertilized, the egg is washed again and placed in a rather different medium. This is a medium suitable for fertilization. It is now placed in a medium suitable for growing the embryo. And then after 2 days, the embryo is returned to the patient. Now, further hormonal treatment was also used in order to stimulate the corpus luteum and assist implantation of the embryo. The reason for this is that the treatment given, first of all, interferes with the normal hormonal changes in the cycle, and there is a tendency for the corpus luteum not to develop properly as a result of this. The reason also for this actual approach to the problem was the belief that one had to obtain the oocyte at a very early stage and then make up for the fact that during this period in vitro, it seems to lose a day, as it were, so that when it's returned to the patient, it's actually 1 day behind the development it would have had if it had been left inside the patient. So to overcome that delay, this further treatment after ovulation was used. There are tests with varying doses of human menopausal gonadotropin showed that the number of large follicles that could be developed was directly proportional to the dose. And since several follicles were required, it was decided to standardize on 1,000 international units of HMG for this purpose of stimulating follicle growth. The series of attempts to obtain a baby in this fashion were unsuccessful, as I mentioned, and this shows the various things that were tried. You see that both HMG and HCG were used in the way that I've described. In addition, since these were without success, clomiphene was added here. Also, a normal cycle was used with HCG to precipitate ovulation. After the return of the embryo to the woman, treatment included none in some instances, or several injections of HCG, or HCG and progesterone, or Primolot, or progesterone and Primolot, or clomiphene was tried. Bromocriptine was tried because one of the problems, as we will see, is a tendency for prolactin to increase, and the bromocriptine was intended to suppress that. And this was a summary of the results. There were actually 3 conceptions, but the results were hardly exciting. One was ectopic. The implantation was right at the uterine tubal junction, just inside the oviduct. One aborted quite early. Two, in fact, aborted. Both these abortions were quite early in pregnancy. So after all these 77 patients, they could only claim to have got 3 conceptions and no births. And the problem was what was wrong, why didn't it work? Because this kind of work can be done in experimental animals quite easily. But there we get where the position is that your recipient, the animal into which the embryo is transferred, can be adjusted by selecting it at the right time after ovulation. It can be selected to be in the right stage for that embryo, whereas in this case, the attempt was having to be made to adjust the patient to fit the embryo, and it was obviously unsuccessful. The question, this took something like 5 years, and was a depressing period for both Edward and Steptoe. They then sat down and thought about things rather carefully, and amongst other observations, I should mention this illustrates the results. This is a typical cycle. Rectangles represent menstruation. On this side we have hormones as assayed in urine, the levels being shown by the vertical lines, and on this side plasma assays of hormones, where the values were represented as these white dots. Now, what was done then was to, soon after menstruation, to give 3 injections of HMG, and then an injection of HCG, and then to remove the oocyte 24 hours later, 32 hours later, then fertilize it, culture it, and return it where that dotted line is indicated. Then there were a series of injections with primolot, progesterone, and other substances of that kind, but all to no avail. The LHHCG level descends rapidly in a very depressing way. Obviously, no implantation has taken place. Progesterone likewise descends, and we have this bad feature of a relatively high level of prolactin. When it's a high level, it's considered to be luteolytic, whereas a low level might be luteotrophic. So clearly something was not right here, and it looked rather as if there was excessive positive feedback from some steroid, either estrogen or progesterone, causing this high prolactin level, and a negative feedback effect perhaps inducing the droplet of LH here. The earlier part of the work was highly successful, so this could not be blamed for the lack of conceptions. Among our 44 oocytes recovered, 34 of them were successfully fertilized, and 32 reached the 8-cell stage. So the earlier parts of the work were obviously sound. It was clearly something to do with the later stages. And then, at the same time that this work was in progress, the follicular contents were being studied by another member of the group. This is Ruth Fowler, who is in fact Mrs. Edwards. And she's interested in steroid metabolism. And she found that in follicles selected as preovulatory, the levels of estradiol and progesterone were exceedingly high compared to non-ovulatory follicles. And the thought was, therefore, that the problem had something to do with excessive steroid levels being released and leading to a negative feedback effect. This shows how the larger the number of follicles is associated with higher levels of urinary estrogen. And, of course, the object had been to stimulate a large number of follicles. So clearly, somehow, they had to avoid stimulating and using hormones to produce follicular growth. So it was decided simply to use natural cycles. And the second program was devised. Now here, the patient's urine is analyzed to detect the peak level of LH, and by observation it was found that ovulation occurred about 24 hours after that peak. So there was no preliminary hormone treatment at all. This was a natural cycle. The egg was removed at 20 hours, about 4 hours before it was due to ovulate. The other treatments were the same. That's the business of obtaining the semen, fertilization, culture, and return of the embryo to the patient. And then afterwards, there was no treatment at all. No hormones were given. And right away, things started to improve. Now, this is simply some additional data showing that using this new technique of observing the LH peak did not make it really so much more difficult to recover oocytes. So that in these patients, you see, ovulatory eggs were obtained from a majority, covering quite a range of times, from 15 to 27 hours, but in fact 20 hours on was used as a regular time for obtaining the oocyte. But this shows the improvement now. This is the procedure. Once again, we have urinary levels of hormones here and plasma levels on that side, menses here and here, and here is the observation on the LH level. The urinary LH was assessed at 4 hour intervals, and it was found to show its peak at this point. But to make things easier, a precipitin test was used for determining the LH level in the urine. This is the Huygens-Avis method. It's a kit which can be purchased and gives a rough but nevertheless probably sufficiently accurate assessment of LH level. It's either positive or negative. If you get a positive LH, a positive Huygens-Avis, one then assumes that your LH is up to peak levels, and certainly the actual assays here supported that point. So that in future, in the future work after this, it was always Huygens-Avis tests that were depended on. And then the laparotomy was obtained at 20 hours, was done after laparoscopy, after the LH peak, the oocyte taken out, fertilized, cultured, and re-implanted at that point. And you see that there are improvements. The LH is still not high, there isn't much change here, but the prolactin levels, except for that point, are showing a sign of improving. Even this point is less than half the levels that we had before. The scale is slightly different. So things were beginning to look better, and finally they got their first success. And this was the beginning story of the first child that was born. Just the time after the Huygens-Avis positive for laparotomy, then the implantation of the embryo, and note the difference here, LH rising very rapidly to high levels, so that clearly an implantation is affected and things appear to be going very well. And the prolactin levels, except for that point, are keeping well down. So they do seem now to have obtained the right general conditions. It has to be admitted, however, that continued success after this was not obtained. This is not the whole story. Evidently, other factors are involved, but they feel that they are certainly on the right track. And this is a summary of the latest series of 79 women admitted to study. 11 were sent home because preliminary observation indicated that the ovaries were inaccessible or too badly covered with adhesions. And so they had 68 women who were actually put through the whole procedure. Even with these, even though they had been selected as having satisfactory ovaries, it was still found to be impossible to get satisfactory aspiration in three. In 9, the orate surge was missed, and in 11, although the follicle was aspirated, no parasite could be found. It must have been left behind in the follicle. It's not an absolutely sure procedure. Fertilization did not succeed in 10 cases, and although the egg was fertilized, 3 eggs failed to cleave. This is the worst part of it though. 28 instances where the early development was obtained, the embryo returned, but there was no implantation. But they got 4 pregnancies. These were progressing normally, but unfortunately, one of the women decided to go mountaineering in the 7th month, and so she lost her baby, and another had to be terminated because it was found to be triploid. This is a risk that is involved, and I'll be talking more about that later. All these pregnancies are, of course, monitored all the way through, both by amniocentesis and by ultrasound, and any other hormone levels are checked constantly. So there's a continual monitoring right through. And if an abnormal fetus is detected, then termination is recommended. That's the first one to be born, a boy. This is Dr. Edwards behind all that. And that's the second one, a boy. They are both doing well, they're perfectly healthy, and are growing fast. Now, respectively, 3 and 2 years old, or getting on for 4. One of the smaller points of interest that transpired was seen when the results were analyzed according to time of day when the oocyte was transferred to the woman. And it was found that with the first program, where some conceptions, 3 conceptions were obtained, they were all obtained in the late evening. That seemed to be the best time for implantation. And similarly, with the second program, all 4 pregnancies obtained in the late evening. These results, of course, are very preliminary because the numbers are small. But it does look interesting, and it fits in with many people's experience that when the child decides to be born, it's usually some inconvenient time, either late evening or early morning. Now, getting on to the moral aspect of this work, I wanted to discuss some of the points that have been raised, because the work has attracted a great deal of attention over the world, and there have been many harsh criticisms of this procedure from certain quarters. But I think ignoring the less logical objections, the first logical objection really is that it's not a natural method of reproduction. And this we freely admit. But then caesarean section is not a natural method of reproduction, and early termination, not early termination, but the induction of parturition earlier because of threatened eclampsia is not a natural method of reproduction, and so one could go on. Artificial insemination is not a natural method, etc. So don't think that that is really a very strong objection. Then the point is made that they are experimenting with human lives, that is to say, the lives of the embryos. These embryos are human beings, if you like, who are brought into the world only to be lost again. And some people feel that this is not an ethically acceptable aspect. However, our feeling is that the purpose of the work is to enable women to have babies who otherwise could not, and that inevitably there are losses, and one has to balance the benefits against the costs, as it were. Even though the costs are in terms of a human life, I think there is a further point that the early embryo is barely equivalent to an adult in terms of human rights, rights to life. And of course there is the point that abortion is widely accepted throughout the world, and also the use of IUDs, which prevent implantation and cause a loss of human life. So we feel that that objection is not sufficiently valid to cause our concern. High risk of inducing birth defects. This point has been made several times because the egg and sperms and embryos are subjected to experimental conditions, and we do not know yet, it's so early in this work, whether birth defects might be induced in this way. However, I should say that there is no animal experimentation to suggest that birth defects are induced like this, and there have been thousands of experiments in which animal eggs, mouse, rat, hamster, cattle, and so forth, cow eggs are fertilized in vitro and transferred. And none of this work is there any suggestion that birth defects might be induced. But there are problems here, and I want to talk a bit more about that in a moment. Then is the question that extension of this procedure could lead to social problems. I have mentioned this earlier, that if the egg is obtained from one woman and transferred to another, and she ultimately gives birth to it, whose child is it? They are both, in a sense, biological mothers. In law, probably the one who bore the child would be regarded as the mother. But if it comes to inheritance, it would have to be the mother who provided the oocyte. Altogether, this is a very complicated field. Our feeling is that it should be restricted to the woman's own oocytes and her husband's semen. And we entirely agree that there are many social problems if variations are made on that theme. Now, returning to the matter of birth defects, one of the things that is well established is that if you delay the time of fertilization, you can cause you can interfere with the normal maturation of the oocyte, that is to say, with the production of the second polar body. If the second polar body is not emitted, then the embryo develops as a triploid, as 3N. And also, very occasionally, if eggs are fertilized several hours after their normal time, you find a failure of development of the female pronucleus, which gives you a haploid embryo. You can get non-disjunction occurring, which would give aneuploidy. The egg could conceivably develop without sperm penetration and give what looks like a normal embryo. That would be parthenogenesis, and that could be either haploid or diploid. But parthenogenesis in mammals is not known to proceed further than about halfway through pregnancy. Another worker in Cambridge, Matt Kaufman, has been working on parthenogenesis for some years now, trying every way he can think of to get a mouse embryo to develop through to perm parthenogenetically, but so far without success. They develop to about three-quarters way through pregnancy, and apparently perfectly normally. So why the embryo fails, why the diploid parthenogenon fails at that point, is quite an interesting mystery. And other anomalies can take place. So you have these chromosomal peculiarities which could produce some odd things. The parthenogenons are most unlikely to come through, but triploid human beings have been detected at birth. I think that on the last count that I was aware of, there were something like 15 cases of triploid children being born. But of course, it's not entirely certain that they are triploid in all their tissues, but only in the ones that are investigated. So, however, we have to admit that there is a chance that the triploid embryo might come through if it's not detected. But it is detectable by amniocentesis, so it need not be born. These other two items are very unlikely affairs. Mutagenesis, that's altering the gene structure of the rare in the embryo, is exceedingly unlikely with the procedures used for in vitro fertilization. You would have to irradiate to produce that kind of thing. And then such effect as was produced could be lethal during embryonic development in later generations if you won't produce a birth defect. Teratogenesis is the main worry. Birth defects are a result of teratogenesis. And as I've mentioned, all the experimental work is against the possibility that that could occur. The data that I have seen published on the fate of chromosomal and other anomalies in human subjects in normal pregnancies is summarized here, that of 100 eggs fertilized, about half give rise to embryos which die during the course of pregnancy. 17% are those with chromosomal anomalies, and here we find the tetraploids and the triploids that have been mentioned already. Trisomies probably arise in early oogenesis, and it is quite out of the question that they could be produced by the procedures that we've been talking about. Tetraploids could be conceivably, but are most unlikely. And this monosomy similarly is a possibility, but very unlikely, and could be detected by amniocentesis. Of those that go through to birth, 3% are defect, 3 in 50. That is to say, 6% of children from normal pregnancies are defective in the general population. But of those, only a small fraction are defective because of chromosomal anomalies, and those are mostly trisomies, that is to say, Mongolian syndrome, Mongol syndrome, you know. So that the likelihood of a chromosomal anomaly being missed at amniocentesis and yet developing through is exceedingly small. I should point out too that the patients that come for this treatment are not young women, because these are people who have been trying for some years to have children and only come for this treatment as a last resort. So there are mostly women between 30 and 35. Dr. Steptoe has decided that he will not accept women over 35 because the risks of mongolism and other problems in pregnancy become much greater beyond that age. But in any event, between 30 and 35, there are already higher chances of things going wrong, even with a normal pregnancy. So sooner or later, one of these test tube babies is going to be born abnormal. It can't be avoided, it's inevitable. But the chances of it happening, from all the evidence we've seen, are not higher than those affecting the general population. Now, this is an illustration of just how tough the early embryo is. This summarizes work that has been done mostly in mice. You can take a two-cell mouse egg and remove one of the cells and just implant the other one, and that will give rise to a perfectly normal, healthy and out mouse, or adult eventually, you can take one out of a four-cell egg, and that dog gives rise to a perfectly normal, healthy animal. You can take one out of an eight-cell egg, and the evidence suggests that this will give rise to a normal, healthy animal. It's a difficult experiment to prove, because in order to prove this, you'd have to get eight youngsters developing from all eight cells, and since the chances of development are reduced with this small amount of cytoplasm, it has not yet been possible to get eight young from an eight-cell egg. But at least no abnormal young have been born as a result of that sort of experiment. You can take the cells from an eight-cell egg, from two eight-cell eggs, and push them together, and they will fuse and reorganize and form a single blastocyst, and that will go through and develop into a completely normal animal. Now, when I say completely normal, if one blastocyst is male and the other female, it will be a sort of hermaphrodite, but apart from that, it's a perfectly normal, healthy animal. You can take away half the cells of the early embryo. This is the root of the cells that will form the embryo. You can remove half of those, and this will go through perfectly well. You can take all those cells out and replace them with the cells from another blastocyst and get the same result. You can cut a blastocyst in half and get two perfectly normal embryos. And you can take one cell from one blastocyst and put it into another, and that one cell will contribute to the embryo in a detectable manner. If you select this according to coat color, black coat mouse here, white mouse here, then one-fifth of that mouse will be black. Will be black patches covering about one-fifth of the animal, which is interesting because it means that only about five or six cells in that embryonic mass are going to give rise to the embryo proper. All those things will give you a normal, healthy animal. If we come to irradiation and the use of mutagenic drugs, the position is a little more complicated in that what happens depends on the dose. If the dose is high, you will probably kill the embryo altogether, so nothing will happen. If the dose is sufficiently low, there's no obvious effect, and you get a perfectly healthy animal. If the dose is somewhere in between, you could kill one cell and the other will go ahead, just as this did, and develop into a normal animal, or some of these cells can go ahead and develop. The point being that it's an all or none effect at this stage. During early development from the T-cell to the blastocyst, it's all or none. So that if the embryo is sufficiently hard hit, if it's sufficiently damaged, it will die altogether. If it's just mildly damaged, some of it will die, but the other parts of it will be able to make up for the loss because of this capacity to replace cells that are missing. So that the chances of inducing a best effect by anything you can do to an embryo at this stage, up to that stage, are exceedingly small. And this is the stage, of course, at which the embryos are transferred. Well, we'll finish with a light-hearted note in that I thought you might like to see pictures of the new clinic in
Thank you.
idea is that one of the problems to be dealt with these patients is to overcome their anxiety. They've been waiting for years to have a child, and they think that now is the chance. So they arrive in a highly excited state, and this is quite the wrong condition for them to make good patients. So the treatment involves them staying here for 2 or 3 weeks and doing nothing, just walking around and enjoying the scenery. And then they provide urine samples at 4-hour intervals. They have an operation which lasts about 5 minutes. The actual recovery of the oocyte takes only seconds, and within a minute the oocyte is in culture in another room. And then later on the embryo is returned to the cervix, which is not an operation in that sense. So the interference to the woman is very small indeed. But the important thing is that she should be relaxed and happy and optimistic, probably more optimistic than Dr. Edwards and Dr. Steptoe themselves. But anyway, time will show, and we hope that in a few years' time the test tube baby will be a commonplace. Thank you. I think you've made several very good points there, and I'll try to answer them if I can remember them all. The 6% anomaly includes conditions that develop within the first 2 years after birth. I agree it's very high, but somehow we live with it, because these figures I think are fairly universal, but I don't quite know how widely they apply. And they do include such minor anomalies as color blindness and so forth. It sounds worse than it really is. I think the main point that you make is that treating the sperms, or at least fertilization in vitro, you feel, is a big risk, because the sperm is in an abnormal environment, and so, of course, is the oocyte. But
I come back then, well, you said that mice and rats are not really comparable, but other animals too, and this has been done in monkeys as well, but only in a small number as yet, and it's numbers, of course, that will count. We can't prove, it's not possible to prove that the rate of anomalous development will be higher or not with this method. It's just that all the evidence we have at present suggests that it will not be any higher. And I think when you come to AI, you said that with artificial insemination, the incidence of anomalies is much higher. Did you mean?
Can I have that?
I'd like to talk about sperm selection. There is really no evidence that the female tract selects sperms. But the one that swims strongly may not carry good genes, you see. Yes, I quite agree that you're lacking the selective effect of the female tract, but what I'm saying is there is no evidence that the female tract selects sperms for the normality of the fetus. It may be good at swimming, but that doesn't mean to say the child's going to be good at swimming too. It has no reflection. There is no reflection on the genotype of the sperm. There's no evidence, well, except for one thing which I can talk about later, the teleorial, if you'd like to discuss that. But except for the funny business about the teleorial, there's no evidence that the genotype of the sperm affects its phenotype. So that whether it swims well or not, or whether it's good at fertilizing or not, has nothing to do with whether it's good genetically. What we don't want is stupid buffalo, because they do have to think. I quite agree. And of course, many of these worries will only be solved over a period of time. We'll just have to press ahead and hope for the best, with the assurance that the more obvious anomalies that can be picked up by ultrasound or by amniocentesis can be terminated. And that will account for a very large proportion of the anomalies. The child may subsequently develop some condition before it's 2 years old or even later, but then it will after a long pregnancy anyhow, and we would need a vast number of cases to show that there's an increase when the incidence in the general population is only 0.1% or something like that. I don't think we'll ever be able to prove a significant difference for these minor anomalies or rare anomalies. Coming back to the other point you mentioned about the moral aspect of recommending to a woman that she should or should not go and apply for this treatment, I agree that up to date there have been only two natural births. I think one ought to include the one that was aborted because the mother didn't rest up properly. So the two or three normal pregnancies in this series, at least. But you see, these are all crowded at the end of their experience in Oldham. So the indications are that they are on the way to knowing just what to do in order to obtain a normal child, normal birth. And as experience gathers and increases, I think we're bound to find, if they are on the right track, and they think they are, that the incidence will increase, so that perhaps as many as 30% or 50% of women who come for treatment will in fact be able to have a child of their own. I understand that there are at the present time 6 women in Australia who are pregnant from this sort of treatment, because there's another group there working along the same lines. Not quite, because, well, for reasons which I needn't go into, but at least this evidence is coming along. There are other groups in England who are trying to start up the same technique, and certainly in America and elsewhere. So there's no doubt that in the course of the next few years we'll see a lot more of this, and I think that many of the worries that people have, I trust, will disappear when that happens. As to the expense side of it, it's actually more expensive than you indicated. Apart from the airfare, the fee is £1,500, because they've invested nearly £2 million to get that, pounds, not baht, to get that new clinic established, and they've got to get the money back somehow. But I agree, it's a difficult decision to tell somebody who perhaps can barely afford it to go to all this trouble and expense when the chances at the moment appear to be very small.
You said that this method may help the women who may have a blockage of the oviduct. But how can you differentiate if the blockage would be of the non-hereditary type? Because I'm afraid that if it is hereditary type, it may be passed on to the generations. And this may increase the incidence of genital congenital defects. And I think that if the blockage should have been caused by the inflammatory reaction in the uterus or in the oviduct, the chance of the woman to conceive is even less than the normal one. And this may explain how it is very difficult to be impregnated, something like this. Yes, Professor, please.
Well, about the genetic aspect, I mean, the same argument would apply whether if you are a genetic counselor, whether you advise people to get married when one of them has a hereditary anomaly. But most of the anomalies that we're concerned with are a very rare incidence, and the chances that their children will show the anomaly are very small. And with some exceptions, I'm not a geneticist, so I can't talk about this in great detail, but my understanding is that with some exceptions, people under these circumstances are recommended to go ahead and have children, because the chances that they'll share the anomaly are really very small indeed. So I don't think that need be a factor. And once again, I come back to the fact that many of these anomalies can be detected at amniocentesis, so it is possible to avoid such a thing. You can't, of course, detect the absence of oviducts in the fetus of amniocentesis. If there's a geneticist in the house, I'd like to know whether absence of oviducts is a hereditary condition, and if so, how frequent it is. I think it must be rather uncommon, and certainly by far the greatest reason, greatest cause of blocked oviducts is PID. So I think that that is a fairly small consideration and not really an argument against it. But nevertheless, it's a good point, and these things should be thought about. But I feel that they have been thought about, and that nevertheless, the decision to go ahead with this work is well justified.
Have you ever calculated the cost of a shy, the cost per one shy? I myself think that it is very expensive chai, and in terms of produce a chai with all those costs, and the other thing is that the follow up program for the two test tube babies. Do you have any kind of follow up program or any kind of treatment for those? For the two babies in terms of social and psychological effects for them in the future?
To answer the second question first, no, there is no intention to provide a follow-up service. In England there's the National Health Service, and the women can perfectly well apply for that if they want any help. If the children are born normally, are normal at birth, and as in the case of the two that have been born, are still, so far as one can detect, normal at respectively 3 and 2 years of age, then I don't think one can ask for better than that, because there are not better conditions even with normal pregnancy. The cost is high, but the reasons I've given you, nevertheless, there's a waiting list of about 200 people already. They've closed the list. It's too long. So, I mean, cost or not, people are prepared to take this long chance, as it is at the moment, in order to have a child. People want their own children very seriously, and the old excuse, or at least the old remedy of adopt a child, is not the same thing. And also, children for adoption are scarce these days because of abortion, you know, and contraception, so there are few around, and there isn't a proper remedy for this problem except the one that Edwards and Stepler have devised.
Have you ever done this experiment in human primates, and how many of them that you have done? And at the same time, how many generations that you have served in the experiment in human primates before you start in human beings?
The short answer is we haven't. We don't work on primates. We have not got the facilities to do that work in the laboratory at Cambridge. There are people in the States, I think Dick Ducola is one, and one or two others whose names I can't recall, who are interested in pursuing this line. But I really haven't any idea about the success. I don't know if Dr. Pettitong can think of any successful work on primates of this kind. I don't think there's much going myself. The thing is that primates, that is, non-human primates, have turned out to be more difficult to use than man. And fertilizing the non-human primate egg in vitro proved to be extremely difficult. The human egg was easy, but the non-human primate egg is very difficult. I think somebody has done it, but I'm not sure of that. People have transferred embryos from one primate to another, and these will develop satisfactorily.
Why I asked you this question, because I'm a pathologist, and I think that it might be necessary to observe in many generations before starting human being. You can't expect that in the future the baby pills can produce a stupid baby or a stupid human being in the future. And why I ask you that for the why we not start in human primate before starting human being.
The natural thing is to think of doing primate work before human work, and the law requires that all drugs are tested on primates before they're released for human use. But this procedure is not subject to the law so far. Apart from the fact that the human primate turned out to be, at least the ones that were tested, to be, as I said, much more difficult to use for this sort of work, there isn't, of course, enormous expense involved in non-human primate work. At least in the Western world, it's much better, much more economical here. It will be done eventually, but, you know, testing that sort of thing out in primates, the non-human primates, is a long-term operation, because if you're interested in the question of birth defects, and which may develop only after some years, it will take a generation to test this thing properly, and in the meantime, you could be helping women who, by means, which, from all the evidence that we have, should not give rise to abnormal development. We believe it's safe. There's
a risk. Every new method involves a risk. Thank you very much, Professor Austin. So no more question, and it has been quite interesting indeed to listen to your lecture. And of course, it is an expensive child to be produced. I think it's better to sex the child. You know, if it's in Thailand, we should produce only a daughter so that we can get compensation when she gets married. Well, on behalf of the faculty and the audience, I thank you very much, Professor Austin, for your such a nice and interesting lecture. And I thank all of those who have helped us in putting questions and comments. Thank you very much, sir.